Mental illness.
Yeah.
What do you want to know about mental illness?
Any
questions?
I kind of wrote it in relevance to like the Westboro Baptist Church.
That's a mental illness? What do you mean?
I was saying like maybe there's like people with different mental illnesses and that's why they believe in it.
Okay, so let's start talking about it, and then if you have specific things that pique your interest, whatever, so you'll let me know. What is mental illness? What does mental illness have to do with Torah, with halacha? How does it affect anything? So let's start from scratch. What does it mean that there's a mental illness? So obviously everybody knows that there's something called a physical illness. You can identify it. Torah says already that if a person is sick, if a person was hurt, he has to go to the doctor. So the person that hurt him has to pay for the doctor bills in certain situations. So the Torah already recognizes, here you see, in Parshas Mishpatim, that if a person damages another human being, so one of the things left to pay for is the doctor bills. So, okay. But that's a physical damage. What if there's some sort of psychological pain or something like that? So one of the four payments, nezek, is for damage, physical damage. Person, Rachman Lezon, lost a finger. So you got to pay for the future, what the guy could have worked, and now he can't work anymore for the rest of his life. So it's nezek, damage to the person. There's tsar. Tsar is the physical pain. But sometimes, you know, pain is not physical pain. Pain is only emotional pain. Pain is something that's going on in a person's brain, not really something that's out there in the physical world. So there is something called tsar. You have to pay a person, not just for ripu, sheves, boshes. You have to pay for all these other things. Boshes also, embarrassment, and how much psychological pain when it was involved in the embarrassment.
How do you even measure that?
Yeah, so Chazal have to come up with ways. What would you pay for me to do this to you in a way that wasn't embarrassing, in a way that didn't cause you pain? How much would you be willing to spend to get out of that element of it, and then we can give it some kind of financial price tag. Even though obviously there's a certain absurdity to that, but that's how we come to sort of concrete way to pay for it. So you see already from there that not only is there something called, you know, doctor bills for some sort of physical problem, but there's also a recognition that there is emotional pain, there is distress, there is all the other types of pain as well, and other types of issues as well. Where this comes up the most is when we categorize a certain person as being exempt from mitzvahs. What am I talking about? So we know there's a group of three that come up in Mishnayos again and again and again and again. What are those?
Blind. Women and children.
What's the official phrase?
I'm not sure.
There's three people always listed together. You're thinking Nashim, Avadim, and Ketanim. But Nashim, Advarim, and Kitanim, Nashim, Minor, Chayiv, and Mitzis.
Blind, insane. And, I don't know.
So, Cheresh, Shaita, Vakatan. Cheresh, Shaita, Vakatan. Cheresh, and Vakatan. Those are the three that come up all the time. It comes up all the time. All the time. So, Katan, we know. Cheresh, you're saying is blind, but really it means a person who's a deaf mute. Because the reason why we're distinguishing between a deaf mute and what we're about to discuss as a Shota is because a person who's a deaf-mute, back in the times of Chazal, we didn't know their degree of intelligence because they really, Rahman al-Islam, didn't have a way to communicate. If you have a person that can't hear and he can't speak, how do you have any idea what's going on in his mind? The way that people learn how to speak is by listening to the sounds and then repeating the sounds, copying them, and doing that themselves. So a person back in the day couldn't hear anything, how's he ever going to learn how to communicate? So we have sign language, all kinds of things about us. It's an amazing world we have. It's an amazing, amazing, amazing world we have. About us. But because of that, there was a real suffix as to whether or not these types of people really were of any mental capacity at all, because how are you going to know? So that's the category. And the question, of course, is going to be, how does that reflect itself or apply bizman azeh, when we do know that the person is highly intelligent, it's just that they don't have the ability to, you know, to hear.
How do they go about, like, explaining, like, I mean, not explaining, but, like that the kid would understand, or, like, mm-hmm. How would, like, a deaf/mute person understand what's going on around them, like speaking of Judaism, like...
What do they do as man as that? Like, how do you teach
them? Not today, but, like, back then, like, when you know, people thought that they had no mental capacity, and they probably just sat there and not understanding.
They're exempt from mitzvahs. That's the idea. The chayr shetvakat, and those types of people are totally exempt from mitzvos. But a katan, there's an idea of chinuch. And the chayrish and the shoyta, there is no concept of chinuch because who says they're ever going to progress? So they're totally exempt from mitzvahs. That's what I'm trying to say, is that the category of cheresh is a little bit of an interesting category, because it sounds like it's more of a suffix category. No, so that's what I'm trying to say. Then today's world is very likely that what Chazal referred to as a cheresh would have been much more capable of bisman hazeh. And therefore, they, you know, they could be very well chayav in mitzvahs if you could properly educate them.
Yeah.
So,
right, because there is sign language. Right?
Yeah, nowadays, that's an amazing world.
There's so many different things.
Yeah, Baruch Hashem. So we're not going to deal with cheresh. But what we do need to discuss is what exactly is a shoita. Because I'll have a category of shoita, and a shoita is butter from kol ha-mitzvahs. That, of course, goes right into this issue of really what's called mental health, because there is a category of a person who mentally is just so not well that he is totally exempt from mitzvahs. There's a ma'isa shahaya that we were at a bar mitzvah for an autistic child, and you know, so we went to the bar mitzvah and they gave him an aliyah, and the kid made the bracha, and like, you know, he repeated everything that he was supposed to say. But it's very hard to know what's the story with the mental capacity of an autistic child.
Also, I mean, it also depends, like, because there's different, like, levels of autism, like, there's such a spectrum, so, so, I mean, some kids have the ability, like, yes, you can say he has a mental disability, but some kids some people with autism have the ability to understand, and others don't at all.
So I asked the Rav at the time, like, what's going on over here? Is this kid really having a bar mitzvah? See, he told me that he didn't really think so. That he thought that the child really was mamish, like a parrot. You know, he was just repeating whatever he was told to say, but he didn't really have an understanding of what he was doing. So I said, how can you give him an aliyah? He told me that's the fifth chelik of Shulchan Aruch, that you know, the parents worked so hard and did so much for this child, and to tell them that the kid can't have an aliyah and can't have a mitzvah, whatever, would have been like a total disaster. And so he was a super makel and allowed certain things.
Well,
that's what he was saying. Yeah, is that he felt
do things even if he doesn't have an understanding of it.
Well, but that's part of the question. That when you're dealing with being motzi at Sibur, and Sibur has to be yotzei certain things and whatever. Like, what is the story with his brachas? And you know, so all that are interesting questions. Which you know, he felt that under the circumstances, that was what was appropriate.
Can I ask you another question? But yeah. Okay. Off topic. It's very on topic, but very off at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
What about people who come into this world and they don't have any obligations because of it, like because of being a deaf special person or being insane, and they don't have any obligations because of it? Why, like, what's their purpose? Is their purpose in order to make someone else's life a different challenge?
Mm-hmm. So there's no real way to answer this question. This question is going to be one of those questions where there are many possibilities, and in most of the time we'll never really know what a Kaddish Baruch Hu had in mind. Obviously, like you said, that it does present opportunities for other people to do chasadim and you know and whatnot. It also means that the person themselves is exempt from mitzvah, so it's not like they bear any personal responsibility. There, of course, are those that suggest that this person has been sent back to the world, that generally speaking, perhaps these people are Gilgulim, and they're either there to just do something or allow something to happen that can be viewed in a negative sense, that the person is there to be punished because they did something wrong. You know, there are different ways of looking at that. To definitively argue any one of those positions, this is an absurdity. How could you ever say with any sense of definitiveness what exactly is going on? But these are things that we don't understand. Kaddish Baruch Hu has all kinds of ways to work things out. And so, you know, whatever it is, but certainly a person that is given such a child is being given the opportunity to do these types of chasadim with the awareness that that type of person has the capacity to be able to do it. That other people, they lack the patience, they lack the understanding, they lack the sensitivity, and they're not put into the situations. You know, a person that is given a situation is given a special neshama to be able to take care of them and grow themselves, of course, through their sensitivities and whatnot. But certainly not to make a claim that anybody that comes to the world and is an autistic or something, you know, or is, let's say, a mute, is being punished because they said Lashon Hara in their previous life. Like, this is not the... You can't say things like that. You just can't say things like that. Okay, so that's the extreme position in terms of mental illness, is that there is a category called a shaita. And the shaita in modern Hebrew, there's another milk, by the way, that's fresh. The shaita in modern Hebrew is sort of used as to call someone an idiot. So that's, of course, very, very not nice, but it's the borrowed term, just like people called people, retarded, when that was a typical term years ago for a person that just had a mental illness. So these are all just people being obnoxious and taking words that have a technical definition, and using them to be rude and crude. But the technical definition of a shaita is a definition, la halacha, that there's a definition of shaita, and there has to be a certain category that is going to be a shaita. Why am I saying it like that? Because Josh mentioned that even when it comes to something like autism, there's a spectrum. In fact, that's what they say, the autistic spectrum.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? That means that it sometimes is going to get a little complicated to define a person as a shaita. Where do you draw the line between a person that's just not with it and a person that's actually a shaita?
Right.
And that is the gray area of halacha that's going to be the big area of question. You're going to have situations where it's clear to everybody that this person, okay, he's not exactly with it, but he's normal type of person. He's not putter from mitzvahs. He has certain, what would we call it in English? What do you say? He's very eccentric, He's like an eccentric personality. Yeah, no?
Probably, I just don't know.
There's certain people that in specific areas of their lives, they're very extreme. Mm-hmm. So in general, the person's normal. Whenever it comes to this issue, they're bizarre, they're out of their mind. So some people are very eccentric. You just need to heat up probably. Would you just turn it on, right?
Yeah.
You just need to heat up. Give it a couple minutes. It'll heat up and it'll start blinking. But in any case, so it's going to be a little bit difficult to define. Let me just abstract this for 1 minute. There's an important point that needs to be made that maybe you are aware of or whatever, but I'll spell it out anyway. When halacha says there's something called a shaita, what everyone's going to want to do is now go into the book of psychology, abnormal psychology or whatever, and try to figure out, where does psychology draw the line? Now, what's the problem with that?
I'm not sure.
You have an idea? The problem is a definitional problem.
I was going to say that.
Of course you were. There's no way to guarantee that the halachic definition of shaita is going to jive with what it says in abnormal psychology. Sometimes it's going to make sense. Sometimes it might. But there's no way to guarantee. So if you're a psychologist, you're not using halachic definitions or halachic parameters. And we'll have to discuss that. What are the parameters that psychologists and psychiatrists are using to determine what type of mental illness it is and how to address it? And what is their agenda? What do they care about in terms of their definitions? Because if you're trying to define something in halacha, what are you trying to get out of this conversation, this research that you're doing? You want to know if he's pater from mitzvahs. So what you need to do, because that's the nafkamina. So once you set up, who cares? What's the agenda here? Then you can start defining it. I think you're good to go. So in halacha, the shaila is going to be, is this kid chayav in mitzvahs or is he pater from mitzvahs? So if he's defined as a shaila, open it up and close it and then push the button. If he's defined as a shaita, so that's a whole science. So then he'll be pater from mitzvahs. So, what the halachic person is going to do, what the poisek is going to do, is what? How is he going to define? How's he going to know? Come on.
By speaking to a psychologist.
No, but dafka not, right?
Yeah.
Specifically not, because those aren't the definitions that he needs necessarily. So what's he going to do?
I'm really unsure.
Come on, yes you do. If you have a shaila in halacha, so where do you go?
A rav.
Okay, you'll ask the rav. What if you're the rav?
Ask another rav.
And what if you're that rav?
Ask the rav.
Oh, come on. So how's the posse going to figure this out? What does he need to do? He needs to good. He needs to define shaita. How is he going to define shaita? He's going to have to look at all of those places that shaita is discussed in Chazals. And he's going to have to try to pick out of it what is the actual definition. Good? That's legal research. Anytime you're researching a legal concept, you got to figure out what are the parameters, what's the definition of the legal concept, and that's how you fit something into it, and that's what the lawyers are going to debate, whether you're right, whether you're wrong. Maybe you're picking on the wrong part of the definition. You're stressing something in the definition that shouldn't be stressed or shouldn't even be there. So, for example, when it comes to the issue of electricity on Shabbos, so is electricity defined by heat? Is it defined by light? Like, what defines electricity that we can now have some kind of definition for it and work with it in Hilchos Shabbos? So here, we need a definition of a shoita. So whenever the halachic personality is going to do that, you're going to look in all those places, you're going to see that there's certain... Halacha defines a shoita as a person that sleeps in a cemetery, that does all kinds of things that are very antisocial behaviors, and the definition you'll come up with is not necessarily going to jive with the one you'll find in an abnormal psychology book. Now, let's shift it a little bit to try and understand that idea a little bit better. If you are a psychologist or a psychiatrist, so how do you view mental illness? You're not viewing, wow, is this person putter for mitzvahs? You don't care about that. What does the psychiatrist care about? What is their agenda? What are they trying to accomplish? What's going to enable them to define their terms?
They literally, I don't know what their goal is to diagnose
him. So,
just be their goal.
Why? And what's going to provide a diagnosis? Like, who says that person's sick? There's a person that you know that is mamish, from your perspective, berserk. But they don't care. Now, are they functioning in society or they're not functioning in society? Are they driving everybody around them nuts? So, because psychology, psychiatry, because they lack a God, a religious definition, I'll say it like this, because they lack an objective definition. So what mental illness becomes is it's not really a mental illness until it affects the person's functioning. If it affects the person's functioning, you can start to define it as a mental illness. If the person and the people around them, that they function fine as far as they're concerned, like they don't really care, so then it's not a mental illness. So you can imagine, you'll excuse me, but you can imagine a person that is experiencing homosexual tendencies, and that person views himself, because he's a religious personality, as having a mental illness, and you'll go to somebody else, and they'll tell you, what are you talking about? That's the way that God made you, and what kind of mental illness is that? If a person feels he cannot function in his society because of some issue that he has, so he's defining himself as having a mental illness.
Right.
But another person will look at that and say, well, how could you define that as a mental illness? That's just another way to live. That's an alternative lifestyle.
Who would ever define this as
a secular person?
What kind of realm are we talking about?
No, not a realm. I'm just saying a secular person. That's the big debate this man is here, right?
What kind of problem are we talking about?
Oh, like saying homosexual tendencies, let's say.
Oh.
So a person that's a religious personality wants to deal with that in a certain way. And then you go to the psychologist, and they're not even allowed. The psychologist is not allowed. No, they're not allowed to consider
mental disease.
No. In psychology.
In religion.
I'm saying that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
Define your terms. What does it mean, mental illness? Is he a shota?
Yeah.
Of course he's not a shota.
No.
It's chayav mitzvah. It's 100,000%. So what does it mean he has a mental illness? So what I'm trying to present to you is a definitional problem. When we speak about... I want to present this in a way where it's very clear.
Rav
Soloveitchik was very, very forceful on this.
Yes.
He says, halacha has definitions. You can't come to me and say, how does halacha view democracy? When the halacha doesn't talk about democracy. The Torah doesn't talk about democracy. Is the Torah democratic? Let's say it differently. Is the Torah anti-feminism?
No.
Is there any ism? What does the Torah say about communism? Is the Torah communist?
No.
The Torah doesn't define its terms like that. So you're taking a certain definition that doesn't exist within the Torah's confines, and you're trying to figure out in the Torah how to... So you could do your research, and you could come up with a thesis, but that's not the Torah's terms.
The Torah is not political. It's not for a gender. It's not for any of you. Like, none of those things apply to the Torah. It's just a way of life.
So, mashal, amadar adayma, it's not exactly the same. But in a certain sense, if you want to give it a mashal, it's like going to a guy who's programming computers. He's a computer scientist, he's a computer programmer. And you want to help him out. So for Hanukkah, you're going to give him a present. It's going to help him at work. And you bring him a hammer. Is that your... We want to do that. It's a tool. You need tools. It's a tool. You'll use it for computer programming. How many of you guys, I can break the computer with it if I get frustrated, but that's not going to help me program the computer. What do you mean it's a tool? What's the problem? Well, because these aren't my tools in my area. You can't do that. And you try to bring a proof. You bring a mathematical, we were talking about this the other day, you bring a mathematical proof in math. But there is no such thing as a mathematical proof in a legal system. You have to use logic and you have to use, what do you call it, precedence. That's how you work. So the tools of one trade or one area are not the same tools in other areas. So that's the problem we're going to have here. You want to know what's the Torah's approach to mental illness. What's a mental illness? So the way we're going to have to define mental illness in halacha is, well, what's the nafkamina? If you give me a nafkamina, then I'll be able to say, well, let's figure out what goes into defining that thing that we should come out with the answer to that.
Like, interesting. Depression is a mental illness. People with depression
exactly. So is he a shoyte? Because if the issue at hand, well, nafkamina, you want to take issue, whatever you call issue, we call nafkamina. If the issue at hand is he chayiv and mitzvahs patur from mitzvahs, so then the only question is the person defined as a shoyte or not?
Some kind of level of comprehension in the end, no?
Right. So as long as the person is, you know, is not in that gray area of like autistic spectrum, you know, where it's hard to know what the person's capacity is. So if we know the person has regular capacity, but sometimes they get, you know, they get depressed. Okay. So
now,
there is a concept of a shaita, that the person is a temporarily a shaita. They lose their mind temporarily. You can have a person that's manic, you can have bipolar, you can have different types of personality disorders, and maybe that's not, but whatever. You can have different types of disorders that the person could be temporarily defined as a shaita. In fact, the halacha talks about Hilchas Pesach. Let's say, I think we discussed this when we were talking about halacha. Let's say a person was literally totally out of it because of their issue while they're eating their matzah. And then they snapped out of it, or the drugs took effect, or whatever. Now are they chayven, or they're not chayven? They ate the matzah in a state of being a shote. So the halacha says, the Rambam says, the Rambam passes this halacha, we learned it the other day. The Rambam says he was pater for mitzvahs when he was eating his matzah. He'll have to eat matzah again.
Well, what kind of thing are we talking about? Because bipolar people don't necessarily...
Probably like a schizophrenia or something like that, where a person really is just like not with it, and they sometimes they go in and out of it. So now they're with it.
Okay.
Please, go ahead. That's what I was telling you. The temperature changes. So that's important in terms of defining things. So what do we have clearly? We have clearly is there will be a certain person that's going to be defined as a shaita. They're going to be totally exempt from it. So you have another type of person that is clearly with it. They have certain, you know, issues occasionally, but they're definitely chayav and mitzvahs at least most of the time. And then there is going to be that gray area. Now, what areas of mental illness come up most that are, I don't know, something I guess that we need to definitely talk about the most? So depression, unfortunately, is very much out there. And what happens if you have a person that needs to be addressed in certain ways that are going to cause him to violate mitzvahs, you know, to recover or whatnot? So Rav Asher Weiss has a whole tshuva about this, where he assumes that that's part of the recovery process, and if that's part of what's necessary for the person to recover, it's okay. So then that's, you know, that's what you got to do. A person's a chayla, and maybe there are details in that, so a person should definitely consult a posek if issues like that come up. One of probably the biggest issues is OCD. OCD is obsessive compulsive disorder. It means that a person becomes so fixated on details that it becomes very difficult for a person to function. It's really, I think it's an anxiety disorder, and it has to do with the anxiety that a person experiences towards certain things that come up. For example, you could have a woman who's supposed to go to the mikveh, and to go to the mikveh is a lot of details and a lot of pressure, because she knows that if she doesn't do it right, then it's going to be a chiv karis between her and her husband. So there's a lot of pressure. And if there is an underlying issue of OCD, so then it's going to be very, very difficult for her to get through this. Have you ever seen people in shul that say, Shema Yisrael, Shema Yisrael, Shema Yisrael? Have you ever seen this?
No.
I've seen this several times. Several times. That there's a person that's in shul trying to say Shema correctly, and they get they don't get the word right, they go back. And they go back to the word, they get a few words more, and then they go back. There are people that, you know, are fixated, they have certain, you know, what do they call it? What do you call it when you do something like a ceremony? We have a, they have a certain thing that they have to do before they can...
Ritual.
A ritual. They have like certain rituals, and then they can't do something until like they've done their ritual.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I mean, this isn't OCD at all, but it's kind of like a lot of basketball players, like every basketball.
That's like luck.
But like, before they shoot a free throw, every single one has a routine. Like,
Carl
you see them as a line. Each, like, they might bend their knees a little and like, they'll take three dribbles, or they might, like, I do this when I go to take a free throw, I take the ball and I spin it backwards twice in a row.
Right.
It's just like a habit that, like, you get into it every single time. Except, obviously, it's not a mental illness.
Right. So, yeah. So the problem here is that let's say that you have a person that you know is trying to become religious, and it looks like they're really super exacting in mitzvos, but they're really not happy, and you see that there's like there's something going on here that you think is very strange, because on the one hand it seems like they're becoming very frum, they're mamash makbid on every single detail of the halacha. And they're getting depressed. So probably, can't guarantee, but probably it's because the person is fixated on the details because they have OCD that's being enhanced, in a negative sense, by their observance of halacha. And that's exacerbated, that's a good word, thank you. I didn't get that much sleep. So that's a really huge problem. And so someone's going to ask you, what is the difference at the end of the day between OCD and a really religious person? What? So you've just taken halacha and you just made it OCD? What? That's a chalashar. One of the things I mentioned to my shul this past Shabbos was that one of the things that comes out of all these parashios of Mishkan is that you know what, a Kadosh Baruch Hu really does care about details.
Yeah.
You know, he cares about the details in the command, Truma Tetzav, and he cares about the details in the fulfillment, if I ask him Pakudim. So it's OCD. Okay,
but
so,
I think the OCD here is a problem of not being a religious thing. It's something that happens in their daily life outside of religion also. For like, and it's the fact that whether it's them saying Shema Yisrael or them, like, let's say, like doing a simple daily like task, like let's say like even making waffles, like let's say. Like, they had this routine, and they had to do it perfectly every single time. And let's say he didn't put in the right amount of sugar, like, and he's like, I have to redo it again. Like, like that kind of thing, it's outside of religion and wanting to get it right. It's wanting to be perfect in every single aspect.
Correct, correct. But once a person has in their mind that they have to do this way, so that, it, like you said, it exacerbates their whole problem, and it creates a disaster. It creates a real churban of the person. So one issue is, okay, so now what do you do with that person? So the answer is, that person needs to be seeing somebody to be working on this issue, and if that is, working on the issue means he's not following all of the details of halacha, which is what's going to have to happen, so that's what has to happen for the person to get better. The person's sick. So that has to be addressed in a way that in a harami is going to create certain, you want to call it violations of halacha, call it whatever you want. But whenever there are people that are sick, so halacha is violated for them. We're machal Shabbos for certain people if it's bikuach nefesh. If it's not bikuach nefesh, then you have to define your terms exactly. What are you allowed to violate for this person? So in those situations where a person will have to violate certain things in order to get better, they'll have to consult the posek and see, like, how far can we go? What are we exactly allowed to do for this person who's sick?
What's the way that, like, people are saying Shema wrong? That, like, why is it that they want to, that they would keep, like, repeating?
A normal person has OCD.
Or even not a person.
I should say normal, a well person.
A person who has OCD, like, why is it that he thinks that he's saying it wrong?
Because he heard it. If you don't say the words, you're not yotze. And once he heard it, you don't say the words, you're not yotze. Then he has to say the words right.
How is he saying all the words wrong?
He probably isn't.
Yeah.
But he's anxious. It's an anxiety disorder. He's anxious that maybe he didn't say it right.
Yeah, well,
and then he's not sure he did. So he goes back just in case. Mm-hmm. And that time also, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. So that's the problem. So you get a woman that's preparing for the mikvah for hours and hours and hours and hours because she's really not sure she did it right. Did I remember to do that? I marked it down. But maybe I wasn't thinking. And they question themselves. And the anxiety, because of what they want out of it, makes them do it again and again and again. So, okay, so one issue is, what do you do for this person in terms of halacha? So the answer is, okay, they got to get their post. They can figure out how far can it go that they can, quote unquote, violate halacha in order to get better. Okay. The other issue is, forget the person themselves. Someone else that walks in here and says, ha, halacha is just OCD. So are they right or are they wrong? And if they're wrong, why? So obviously Kadosh Baruch Hu cares about the details. But it just results in a person being so focused and anxious about halacha that it's basically giving everybody OCD. Okay, so the answer is like this. If you see a person and they're so makbid on every detail that they're getting depressed, then they probably have OCD. If you see a person that's makbid on every detail and they're even a little anxious about it because they want to do it right, but at the end of the day, it's with a simcha because they know it's serving a Kadosh Baruch Hu the right way. And there is a simcha there because they're happy to serve a Kadosh Baruch Hu in the right way. So that's healthy about a session.
See, I mean, just because something is supposed to be detailed to me, it's like an OCD. It's just, I mean, like there's a way to do things right, but then there's OCD and wanting to make sure everything is perfect. And then thinking maybe possibly you didn't do it right.
Right. Yeah, so that's something that a lot of people discuss with Zman HaZeh.
Does OCD also have like an insecurity within it? Like of things, like you said, like they're probably not saying Shemarim, but they think they are?
That insecurity is a result of the anxiety. Yeah. But because they're anxious that they didn't do it right, so it results in an uncertainty, which then makes them do it again.
Right.
Not sure what else to discuss exactly what direction you want to go in, but the basic definition, if a person is involved with psychiatry, psychology, bizman hazeh, so the basic definition of a mental illness is, well, does this bother you?
Yeah.
So if it bothers you, then we should try to fix it. If it doesn't bother you, then you know, then what's the problem? Obviously, when it comes to halacha, so it's going to be a little bit different because maybe it doesn't bother me, it does bother you, but it should bother you because you're not able to fulfill the mitzvahs of the Torah, you're not able to do Avodas Hashem properly. So that's enough to define it as a mental illness, and, you know, in that sense. But that's the story there. What else do you want to talk about?
I'm not sure.
It is important that we be aware. A lot of times we're presented with friends that come to us with a certain issue. And you notice, when you try to resolve the issue, that it just seems to come up again. And we, as a starting point, we always address issues that come our way as, in a vacuum, that's the issue, how do we address it? What happens sometimes is, when you get a sense, by knowing the person, and over time, that this is an issue that comes up again and again and again, so the issue is not that issue. Obviously, there's a deeper issue here, and this is the way it's being expressed. But obviously, we're not dealing with it right, because it keeps coming up again and again and again and again. I know a person who recently lost their job, and they were told a certain reason why they lost their job. Okay, I was surprised that they lost their job, because it made a lot of sense. The person fit in this particular position very well. I happen to know the person, and you know, I sort of made a comment, how long has this person ever held a job working for somebody else? Because I know that the person is not what we would call a team player. They like to do things their way. And if you don't like, you know, my way or the highway. So a person like that has a boss, it doesn't work well. So, but that wasn't the reason, apparently, that they were let go. So right away, I tried to, you know, pull some strings to help the person, you know, like, why did this happen? Maybe we can get them their job back or whatever. And of course, as I dug deeper, what's the real truth? The real truth is that they are not a team player and they can't handle them anymore. And they do certain things that they feel are inappropriate because they don't listen to anybody else. And that's really the reason why they let them go. So it's a pattern again and again and again and again. So if a person is not willing to recognize that on their own, so then how do you help such a person? There's no mental illness. How do you know there's no mental illness? Because they're not going to the therapist to help them because they don't recognize that there's a problem. Other people recognize
it. Even if they recognize a problem, sometimes they're afraid to.
Okay.
A lot of times it's like a very, like, sometimes it's ego. Sometimes it's another thing might be maybe not ego, but kind of try to deny the fact. Even though they know, they try to deny it and try to downplay it. And also just like saying, I don't want to go to a therapist. Like, they're scared to change.
Yeah, the taboo. Oh, it's scared to change. Yeah, scared to change is a big deal. People are very scared. Agreed. A million reasons why a person might not go. But what we need to know about ourselves is that the hardest person to really know is sometimes ourselves. Because we can see a million cute ways to say this, but you know, we see everybody else's blemishes except for ours. You can have a person like a rough. And he's helping people day and night. A therapist, that's what they say. You know? The psychologists need the psychologists. They help people day and night. But they can't see it in themselves. So in a lot of ways you can compare this to addiction. And that's a big question. You know, is addiction also a mental illness? And if you look it up online, you'll see that technically speaking, addiction is in what, you know, the DSM? The DSM is officially the Bible of what's considered to be a mental illness. It defines everything. So the DSM has addiction as part of a mental illness because it affects the brain. It affects the way that their brain functions, and then it affects the function of the person until they're not functioning in society the way that even they would want to, or other people around them think is appropriate. So because of that, that is considered to be a mental illness as well. So addiction also is in this whole parasha over here. So the bottom line, I think, one of the bottom lines in terms of halacha, in terms of Torah, is that 100% there is the recognition that there is not only physical illness, there is something called mental illness. There is nothing to debate. There is definitely something called mental illness. The spectrum of mental illness is a very broad spectrum. It's a spectrum between a person who really is going to be totally putter from mitzvahs to a person that totally chayav in mitzvahs, and everywhere in between, that the person has to be helped in a way where you have to have the guidance of a posek to figure out exactly what can be violated, what cannot be violated. Obviously, pikuach nefesh is docha, you know, Shabbos and everything else. Yeah.
Would a certain person who has like a mental illness be exempt in certain mitzvahs, but not in others?
Well, it depends. Probably, if a person needs help and needs to violate certain things because they can't function in certain ways, OCD or whatever, so you'll have to. That person would have to get direction from a posek. What exactly, is there a line that they shouldn't cross in terms of, you know, violating something? I remember in high school, there was a boy who really, he was not well. We thought he was fine, but all of a sudden he just, like, you know, he broke down. So I guess part of this process that the psychologist felt was that he can have absolutely no responsibilities, no anxiety about anything, he has to drop everything. And so, you know, everything Torah had to endure went totally out the window. Nowadays, you know, the guy's, I don't know how healthy he is or not. You know, he's married, and, like, you know, so seemingly, you know, he's doing well. His wife is not Jewish, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, was that appropriate? Was it not appropriate? I don't know. It doesn't seem to have, in a religious sense, gone in the right direction. What?
Jewish psychiatrist?
I have no idea who. You know, it was in high school. I have no idea what was going on other than we felt terrible for the kid. So there needs to be guidance of a psychic, you know, how far one can go. I mean, there are situations, Rahman al-Tzalam, where a person is at risk of really hurting themselves. So everything for that person may be pikuach nefesh in terms of what you're doing for such a person. So it could be that anything, you know, goes out the window. Shvichus dam gilrayus, you know, whatever. Okay, but what is that? But other than that, everything kind of goes out the window in order to help the person. Otherwise, then you got to figure out what would you do for a chole shein bo sakana, you know, a person that's sick that doesn't have a danger to their lives. So there are a lot of derabbanans that don't apply in those situations. There are derabbanans where the rabbanan did not make their gzeiros in those situations. But then you have to be well educated if that's the case, to know what things can be violated and what things cannot be violated, you know, and in what way or whatever. One of the big issues that is not at all going to result in a person being defined as a shote, but is a big issue that is in a certain way hard to deal with, because one of the biggest problems with mental illness, and this is why psychiatry in a certain way has like a leg up on psychology, is that psychiatry can say, we'll take this medicine and we'll address this issue. So even though I can't tell you where the virus is, I can't tell you this is what we're trying to address, but I can tell you that whatever's going on with the chemical imbalance, taking this drug will then balance it out. So at least, you know, as a chemist, you know, we can say, well, it works. In psychology, it's like, we're trying to tweak this and tweak that. What's the problem? The problem is the way the person perceives things. The problem is biology. The problem. So it's really hard to figure out what exactly you're trying to address. So there are different ways to address it. There's behaviorists and there's cognitive therapy, and then usually you have to put them all together, and sometimes you have to include all kinds of medicine, drugs, in addition to all of that, to then address the person. So on the one hand, he's on the drugs to try and balance it out chemically. On the other hand, we're working with him cognitively to try to think about things in the right way, and we're also working with him behaviorally that, like, just do this in this way, that also has a tremendous effect on a person, and sometimes it affects the cognition as well, just because he's behaving in the right way. That we know from Sifrei Musar, that hachitzonus me'oreres es hapanimius, that by doing certain things, it changes the way we feel inside. So what we call, you know, personality disorders are people that, and again, a huge spectrum. You can have people that are antisocial. These individuals engage in repeated behavior exhibiting exploitation, harm, and disregard of others. So these are people that, in every which way, seem just very, very normal. But all of a sudden, certain areas, they're like totally manipulative and like mean. And it's out of whack. So that's defined as a certain antisocial personality disorder. And there are all these different types of disorders that have to do with personality. And, you know, so the truth is that everybody's on a spectrum when it comes to these types of things. There are certain people that are just more in this direction and more in that direction. And it's not until it reaches a point that the person themselves or somebody else feels that they're not functioning that becomes defined as a real disorder. But everybody has certain situations that they're in where they're, you know, they respond and react in a certain way. So, yeah. So you have to know what's what. Let's just quickly, this is what we put together called rabbinic counseling. So the editor, it's a collection of essays from a lot of different people. So the editors are Levitin and Rav Tursky, or Avram Tursky, the psychiatrist. So one of the things that they have here is just a definition, understanding various mental disorders. So they categorize them and give you a sense of them. So just to run through them so you can just be aware. So there's something called anxiety disorders. So we right away, intuitively, we understand what that is. But examples of them are people that are having panic attacks, where these get very nervous in certain situations about certain things. And the panic attack can get worse because people are nervous about getting another panic attack. So that's, of course, all rooted in anxiety. There are phobias, people that are afraid of certain things that don't make rational sense. Like you see a little spider and you're freaking out. Like, why are you freaking out? It's arachnophobia. There are social phobias where people are afraid of social, you know, situations. And again, it's a phobia. They're mamish terrified of being seen in public, being out in public, whatever. OCD is included in anxiety disorders. Post-traumatic stress disorder. A person can have like a really terrifying experience and then it affects them afterwards. People that come back from war, obviously. These are things that we go through all the time. So that's called anxiety. And then those are called mood disorders. Mood disorders is defined as a different category. It includes emotional states that fluctuate from stable to depressed to elation and euphoria. So depression, of course, that's what, you know, one of the things I'm talking about. There's bipolar, which means that a person has dramatic ups and downs. There's what they call manic episodes, where a person is like super creative and doing super well. You look at this person like, wow, they're like a genius. And then they get totally depressed and they're just not functional.
People think like bipolar is like kind of on and off, like they're out of date. But like, it's like long
Right, right. And then there's, you know, real psychotic disorders, which are things like schizophrenia, people that are delusions, they have hallucinations, all kinds of things. And then he includes over here also substance-induced psychotic disorders. The people that are taking amphetamines, taking the LSD, whatever, all kinds of drugs. That's another category. And personality disorders is the thing that I just mentioned to you, a couple of minutes ago. So those are typically how they're categorizing things. Bisman has that. I just want to mention that everyone should keep in mind that as you, Mirz Hashem, you get older and you have Kinderlach, and sometimes even ourselves, we were never properly dealt with necessarily as children. But there's also something called ADHD. And ADHD is something that for some reason has exploded in recent years, and that's viewed by some in a very sarcastic way, by saying that, well, because you think everybody's ADHD and you're not willing to work on people's concentration and focus, you just want to give it medicine. And if anybody takes Adderall, they'll be able to study better for their tests. I don't know if that's true or that's not. But certainly it's supposed to help a person focus. And the claim is it works differently with kids that have what they call ADHD and kids that don't. But again, ADHD, you can't pinpoint the virus. And you can't pinpoint the thing. It's just you take surveys from the teacher and you figure out, well, what are his problems? He's having trouble focusing and he's like just having trouble, with hyperactivity sometimes. And there's a huge spectrum of all of this. But the bottom line is, when you see that a kid is not functioning in school, so you have to wonder if maybe that's a way that it can be addressed. And the problem is, and this is why I think it's really important to be aware of this, is that kids that are not doing well in school, what happens is they start to develop very low self-esteem. And once they have low self-esteem, it really builds on itself and it can really kill a kid. So if you can pinpoint that, and if the parents are willing to say, well, this may be an ADHD issue, let's get him whatever medication works for him, because not all medications work for everybody, and all of a sudden you see that the kid can focus. I'll tell you an amusing story. In Rabbi Zilberstein's Sefer HaRev Noah, so there was a Maisa Shahaya where he was asked an interesting shaila. The Rebbe came to the parents and says, I think your kid has ADHD, you should get him medicine. So they took him in and they ended up getting him prescribed medicine, whatever. And the problem was, they wanted the kid apparently to take it in school or something like that. And they weren't sure how to do it in a way where it wouldn't be embarrassing for the kid that he's popping a pill in front of the other kids. So they came up with a plan. The Rebbe said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to have the kid go get me a coffee. That's going to be his new job. You go get Rebbe a coffee every morning. And when he goes out to get me the coffee, he'll take the pill. So that's what they told the kid. So fine. After a month or whatever, they called the Rebbe, or he calls the parents, whatever, and they agree. Unbelievable change in the kid. Unbelievable. So what sparked the shaila was that they asked the kid, things have been great in school. Do you know what's going on? Like, do you feel it? Do you see the difference yourself? He told him, yeah. Ever since Rebbe sent me to get a coffee, and I put that pill in it, things have been unbelievably good. Rebbe stops screaming at me. He's all calm. And... Can you believe it? Maisa Shahaya. So the Rebbe realized about himself that he was just being too harsh on the Talmidim, especially this one. He needed to relate to him in a positive way. But whether or not the Rebbe had ADHD or whatever, I don't know. But certainly it had a certain effect on him. That calmed him down or whatever, and he wasn't relating them the same way. So the shaila was, does he have to pay the parents for the medicine or not?
That actually happened.
It's a shaila. He has it in the safe.
It's so crazy.
But in any case, the bottom line is that the parents need to be aware. And again, like you were saying, a lot of taboos with all kinds of things. But it kills kids. It kills kids because once a kid has low self-esteem, it's so hard to, to be able to bring him back and to do whatever he needs to do. And if the kid sees that he can do it, he just needs a little bit of help to focus. So then, okay, so as long as he can get him used to whatever he needs to do, and it doesn't affect him, and you have to adjust the medication, et cetera, but whatever it is, it works. And it can work wonders. So you just have to be able to pay attention to what's going on with the kids. But But as I'm learning more and more and more, parenting is not a pashut thing. We always think that parenting is common sense. And sometimes, if you have certain kids, that's all you really need. But sometimes, it's more complicated than that. And you need to know how to address things in the right way. I'll just plant the seed in your minds for later. Reb Zilberstein also writes in Alinu L'Shabeach, in last week's parasha in Vayakel, that Shabbos is a tremendous opportunity for families. Because, you know, it's the week, everybody's away, everybody's working, everybody's busy, there's not a lot of time to really spend together. But Shabbos is the time when everybody gets to spend together, so it's a great opportunity, you know, for chinuch, for from the parent's perspective. The problem is that it doesn't always work out that way. Because people don't always get along, and parents spend so much time on Shabbos with their children that either they get irritated by the children, or they take it as an opportunity to criticize the children for every little thing that they're doing wrong. And instead of Shabbos becoming a time that's very relaxing, very enjoyable, Shabbos becomes a time that's actually very filled with anxiety and frustration and annoyances. So from a parental perspective, we have to keep in mind that Shabbos should be a time when there's really only positivity expressed. Which, by the way, is the ABCs of parenting. You know, eschato aya animaz kir hayom. You know, you try to be like exacting with your children, assuming that they'll always love you. But now this generation just needs so much positive reinforcement. It is unbelievable. Unbelievable. You just have to pick out every little detail of positivity and give a kid, you know, reinforcement for it. That was amazing. You did not bite my finger this time. I'm so happy about that. And it sounds absurd. If you don't do it, it just... every little thing needs to be stressed in all the positivity, and then it really works wonders. So that's what Shabbos needs to become.
What Rabbi Markan said, he has one of his neighbors, and he watches him speak to his kids,
yeah.
And he speaks to them like adults, like completely.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, he said it's like the coolest thing ever. Like, he doesn't, like, the same tone, like you know, that any adult would speak to another adult in, like, without any like, you know, straying off and like speaking to them as a little kid. And they're like little kids.
It's, yeah, it depends on the age. They say that when you speak to kids with baby talk, it actually helps them develop, you know, in certain ways, because you look in every society in the world and everybody's doing that. So they say that it helps them understand certain syllables and certain enunciations and certain ways of doing things. Like, it is beneficial, and that's why everybody does it naturally. But certainly as the kids get older, so to just treat them like babies is not always so good. I've noticed in broyers that there's a certain rabbi, an amazing rabbi, Rabbi Sobel. They're all amazing in their own way. And he has this koach to take the kids from 7th grade into his grade, which is 8th grade. And in 8th grade, all of a sudden, they become these young men. And one of the reasons for it is really obvious, that he speaks to them like they're men. He doesn't treat them anymore like they're little kids. He treats them like they're grown-ups, and he gives them assignments like they're grown-ups. He treats them that way. And so they respond in kind. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, if you have any more questions, feel free to raise them. All right. Should
we? All right, so we're back in an hour.
Is it good?
Yeah, it's good.